Okay, so I'd like to thank Boris and Vernon and Wick and the other organizers for inviting me to this workshop. And again, I apologize for only being here 2 weeks. The point is I couldn't get out of teaching for 3 weeks. So this is the topic I'll be discussing. It's work with Tom Appelquist. And what I'll comment on first is some motivations and theoretical framework of extended technicolor and the challenge of explaining light neutrino masses without a gut-scale seesaw. Then I'll discuss some general features of technicolor in ETC models, specific model, mass generation for quarks and charged leptons, something you know very well, but I'll just run through it in the present context, dynamical symmetry breaking, and our calculations. Then I'll extend this work to the different strong electroweak gauge groups in beyond the center model, including one with left-right, both left and right-handed charge currents, and also gauging a V minus L, and the so-called 422 group, which combines the U1 V minus L and the SU3 collar in SU4 Plati Salam. This is work with Tom, as I mentioned, and there are two papers indicated here, and some further work which we're engaged in right now. So the general question is one that is very important, I think, and we all ask ourselves this. What do we really infer from the discovery of neutrino masses about physics beyond the standard model? A long-standing problem, in fact, has been explaining light neutrino masses in the context of dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking models. And a very common and plausible view has been that light neutrino masses suggest a seesaw involving a Suzy-Gut mass scale with this, you know, standard formula with m-gut of say, 10 to the 16 Joule. Maybe a bit less, 10 to the 15. But the problem is that dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking models do not have nearly this large a scale. Typically, the largest scale is about 10 to the 6 GeV. So how then, how in the world could one explain neutrino masses in these, I'll call them DSB, dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking models? So here, what we'll do is to propose a possible explanation and show how it can be realized in explicit ETC models. In fact, as we'll see, these models do involve a seesaw, but one with mass scales well within the ETC range. Okay, so this is, sometimes I give this for a more general crowd, so you know all this, but just to run through it. We always should remind ourselves that a man on the street could easily ask us a question that we as you know, highbrow field theorists can't even answer. For example, he or she could say, well, why is the electron over the muon mass what it is? We don't know. This is really remains a challenge. The standard model accommodates the quark and charged lepton masses by the mechanism of Yukawa couplings to a postulated Higgs boson. But this does not really provide much insight into these masses, especially since it requires Yukawa couplings of very small size, especially for the first generation, with no particular explanation for that. And of course, as we all know, the standard model Higgs sector is unstable to large loop corrections. Furthermore, the standard model predicts zero neutrino masses, no lepton mixing, and hence, of course, it must be modified to take into account the indications for these. I mentioned these, the solar, the chlorine, Kamiokande, Galax, Sage, Super K, Snow. Atmospheric, the IMB, Kamiokande, Sudan 2, Super K macro, and the terrestrial experiments, K2K and Camlan. Of course, as you know, Super K, Snow, and Camlan have been especially helpful recently.
I'm sorry, I probably forgot something I used to know.
Yeah.
Why is the Higgs sector unstable? Let's put some Higgs.
You know, the mu squared,
negative.
Yeah, you know, this term here, right? This gives you an integral, you know, it's quadratically divergent, right? D4k over k squared, right?
Cut it off.
Yeah, so if you cut it off, it's a quadratic sensitivity to the high mass
so
scale.
What?
So what? Yeah, you can take the attitude, it doesn't make any difference, but some people are concerned. In fact, you know, you raise an interesting point because a real cynic here could say, well, we all live with a hierarchy problem of 10 to the 120. With a cosmological constant. And well, we live with it. I mean, in the 80s, we were told it's naturally m Planck to the fourth or zero. And as you know, people like Coleman wrote papers saying that it was exponentially small, essentially zero. But it's not. And we've learned this from these you know, supernova cosmology measurements and others. So that's a hierarchy problem that vastly dwarfs the one that we're engaged in. So one point of view is you just live with it. So I'm taking a kind of less radical point of view that we try to do something about it. Okay. We could be wrong there, of course. But anyway, since the masses for the quarks and charged leptons and observed neutrinos break the standard model gauge symmetry, an explanation, of course, requires a model for electroweak symmetry breaking. Here, we're going to assume dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking driven by a strongly coupled gauge interaction associated with an exact gauge symmetry called technicolor, mainly due to Weinberg and Suskin, embedded in an extended technicolor theory called ETC due to a number of people, including Suskin, Fari, Demopoulos, Eichten, and Lane, among others. The technicolor theory that we're considering is designed to have what's called walking behavior. It's a bit of a jargon word. It just means slowly running gauge couplings over a certain range of energies, and I'll make that more precise in a second. These have the potential, hopefully, of producing realistically large quark and charged lepton masses and sufficiently small technicolor electroweak corrections. Further ingredients are probably needed to explain the top quark mass and, in certain cases, Nabu-Goldstone bosons.
I thought this program had failed. There are lots of problems.
We'll get to that, okay, how many problems there are, yeah. Mm-hmm. There are problems, that's right. Okay. So, what, yeah, I've given this talk a few times, but it's always to either a conference on DSB or to people who believe in it, okay? So here are a few possible reasons why you might consider it seriously. One, it solves the hierarchy problem, which is, as we call, the quadratic sensitivity of Higgs potential to high mass physics and the associated fine-tuning. Of course, so does SUSY if one can address the mu problem. Most of you know what the mu problem is, and there are possible solutions for that. I think it's always good to remember history. You know, if you forget history, sometimes it hits you over the head. In previous cases of symmetry breaking, it was common to use phenomenological scalar fields in various models. But the underlying dynamics really did involve bilinear fermion condensates. For example, the Ginzburg-Landau approach to superconductivity used a complex scalar field, but the microscopic BCS theory involved just such a condensate, namely this Cooper-Pair condensate. The well-known Gilman-Levy sigma model for spontaneous symmetry breaking in strong interactions involved a VEV for the sigma field. The underlying QCD theory replaced that with the dynamical formulation of a QQ bar condensate, which breaks the chiral symmetry down to a vectorial one, either SU2 cross SU2 or SU3 cross SU3. Perhaps these previous examples from the history of physics are really teaching us something relevant for electroweak symmetry breaking. And then again, of course, perhaps not. Maybe indeed Higgs fields are responsible, presumably as part of a SUSY theory to stabilize the Higgs sector. We will know this, we certainly hope, from LHC in several years. What I'll amuse you with during this hour is the, I guess this is kind of a paraphrase of Robert Frost, the road less traveled by. Okay,
this,
so.
Of course, it's part of a bigger problem that physics does not know a single spinless particle. There is no.
Sure.
No,
except the dilaton, which is
no,
an embarrassment for string theory.
Experimental.
You bet. In other words,
physics,
you bet. In other words, Einstein relativity is a tensor theory, not a scalar tensor theory.
Yeah. String, I think,
and
line,
string theory gives you a scalar tensor theory. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Tony, I agree with that. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So, what's walking technicolor? Well, the technicolor gauge coupling, which is alpha here, described, its evolution is described by the beta function shown here. We'll be dealing with asymptotically free theory, so there's an overall minus sign here. Beta zero, of course, David Gross and Frank Wilczek and Pollitzer computed this. It's a positive then for asymptotic freedom. And the beta one was computed by my graduate student colleague, sadly deceased now, Bill Caswell, as probably all of you know, he died in 9/11. He computed this, and depending on the value of this, there may or may not be an infrared stable fixed point. In particular, if beta 1 is negative, then there is such a fixed point at this value, and this is generically what the beta function looks like as a function of alpha. So, why is this of interest to us? The reason it's of interest is that since we are in an asymptotically free context here, at very high energies, the alpha is very small, and it's evolving upward, but as the beta function decreases in magnitude approaching this approximate infrared stable fixed point, the evolution slows down and, in fact, is very slow over an extended interval of energies. We envision this interval to occur between lambda ETC and lambda technicolor. Eventually, if this infrared stable fixed point is beyond a critical value, alpha critical, at which fermion condensation occurs, then the techni fermions do indeed condense, as indicated here. They gain dynamical masses, and below that scale, in the effective field theory below that scale, they're absent, so the coupling takes off again like that. Okay, but the key point here, and of course, therefore, this is an approximate infrared stable fixed point. If this were really on the right-hand side, then this could get you into the putative non-abelian Coulomb phase. Okay, so this would really be flat. But here, we're not interested in that. We're interested in the case where it is slightly to the right of that, and therefore, we do get a spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking and, of course, confinement. And then this long period of slow running will be important for us.
Carl, is this a conjectured feature of the field theory?
Yeah. Okay, so we see such field theories, yes. In other words, you can imagine, I mean, I'll give you an example of SUN with a particular N sub C, NF designed so that this happens, okay? And so, yes, we have examples, except the sad thing. And you appreciate lattice gauge theory. Okay, the sad thing is that, of course, this is a semi-perturbative calculation. Okay, the first two coefficients, which are the only scheme-independent coefficients, but if this occurs at somewhat large value, and it's of order unity, then you're not sure you trust this. You'd like to do something better. Lattice gauge theory in principle is better. The Columbia group has been working on that for 12 years, and they quoted various numbers and then retract them all because of finite volume artifacts due to the number of Goldstone bosons. The JLQCD group in Japan also worked on it, and they, the Columbia group doesn't believe their results, and I actually tend to agree with the Columbia group.
This is within the assumption of some particular SUN?
Yes. The Columbia group did SU3, and also the JLQCD group concentrated on that. That's right. In fact, JLQCD was using Wilson, if you know these names, Wilson fermions, which are even more problematic. The Columbia group was using staggered fermions, which in principle are better. But even they sort of, they gave up. Norman Chris says, this is too hard a problem. Okay. So
you don't have to have SU3.
No, we're using SU2. But in fact, this has not been answered on the lattice either for SU2. And I keep calling people like Mo Winnie and Norman Crist and all that, but they prefer QCD thermodynamics to this.
Why are there
QCD
field theories that are not have this behavior?
Let's see. Yeah, the cyborg type thing where you get non-abelian Coulomb phases, you can supposedly, using effective holomorphic actions, really tell where the boundary is between the non-abelian Coulomb phase and the confinement phase. So that's on a better footing, except it's not the real world, because you typically have n equal 2 supersymmetry, right? So it doesn't really help.
Well, on the contrary to what you accuse me of, I'm not cynical. I'm just got a bad memory.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that in the old days in particle physics, but this is something you mentioned in about 1 microsecond, there was a scheme dependence of 12 volts. So everything you're going to say is going to be scheme independent. The beta function,
Beta function. Yeah. The first two coefficients are scheme independent. Sure, yeah.
But the higher ones are all.
Oh, sure, sure. Are you thinking of?
The beta function can be regarded as exact, right, for all orders.
Oh, yeah, Tuft had that scheme. Yeah.
Choice.
But there's a big argument over that with the NSVC, so-called exact beta function, which had a pole in it, and there are all sorts of attempts to interpret that.
Where's the error in Tuholt's paper? Can somebody point to an error in Tuholt's paper?
No, it's presumably right. So that you can argue.
But then you won't have.
No, but that's not the point, Tony. The point is that, I mean, we're relying on the fact that the first two coefficients are scheme independent. The problem is not that.
The first two.
Yeah, what's what I have, beta naught and beta 1. Right. But the problem is not that. The problem is this is occurring at order unity, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, in general, you just worry about perturbative or semi-perturbative calculations, right? Okay, so you'd like to do better, but we don't know how to do better at present. Anyway, as we've said, at a scale lambda TC, the technicolor coupling gets strong enough to produce a bilinear technion condensate, shown here, and corresponding dynamical masses for the technifermions. This condensate, it's elementary that it has the same quantum numbers as the Higgs BEV, and therefore it gives the usual MWMZ mass relation. These technifermions are initially zero, bare mass, so that there is, of course, an associated global technicolor symmetry that's broken. You get non-Bogosian bosons. Three of these become the longitudinal modes of the WZ and give these masses. These can be expressed in terms of these techni pseudoscalar decay constants shown here. You can compute what this is. It's about 130 GeV. In QCD, we know that F pi is about 93 and lambda QCD is 170. So roughly speaking, this ratio is about 2 maybe. So we'll take as an approximate value about 260 for this. OK, so to generate fermion masses, one embeds technicolor in an ETC theory. And the role of the ETC gauge bosons is to connect techni singlet and techni non-singlet fermions and thereby to communicate this electroweak symmetry breaking in the technicolor sector to the techni singlet sector. To satisfy constraints on flavor changing neutral current processes, these gauge bosons must have large masses, hundreds of TeV. I'll give you some more detail on that in a second. These can arise from self breaking or tumbling of the ETC gauge symmetry, which in turn requires that it be a strongly coupled chiral gauge theory. And for example, the breaking could occur in this sort of thing, a multi-stage process. One stage would be, say, lambda 1, 10 to the third TeV. Another one, say, 50. Another one around 3 TeV, leaving as an exact residual invariant subgroup of the original ETC group SUNTC. Okay. So this entails a relation between the NTC and ETC, NTC and the number of generations, hence with this equal to 3, that equal to 2. I'll explain that in a second. That's important for us, and it'll have a number of very nice features. We get NETC equals 5. So we'll be interested in an SU5 model of ETC.
So but the number of generations is not predicted, but put into this.
In a sense, yeah. Well, you know, predictions, right? I mean, take the string prediction where you say the number of generations is the magnitude of the.
Nobody's defending string theory here. I'm just asking a question.
I'm not even, it's not a question of attacking. I guess that's a very, if it's true, it's a very beautiful explanation.
No, I'm just asking in the scheme with number of generations prediction.
We choose SU5 to get that, yeah.
Exactly.
But, you know, okay, take what might be an even more appealing thing. You take a given compactification manifold. Mm-hmm. It has a given Euler-Poincaré index. Uh-huh. And then n is equal to the magnitude of that over 2. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. But a typical compactification manifold in string theory has, you know, chi equals 200 or something.
Yeah,
right?
But you're attacking string theory. I'm not talking string theory. I'm just asking you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there are other ways to get it, too. Prion models, right? But prion models.
No, we don't want to talk about prion models. We only want to talk about.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so what are some general characteristics of these models? I'll review this. You may know some of this, but maybe it's good to jog your memory. We'll take the technicolor group to be SU2 technicolor. The technifermions will transform as one subset, shown here. These are the electroweak quantum numbers indicated here. A quark doublet. This I runs from, we'll explain this later, 4 and 5. These are the technicolor indices. The A is color 1 to 3. This is the techni-lepton doublet and right-handed SU2 singlets. These transform in the usual way under the standard model group. So these comprise Under Technicolor, this expression, 8 fermions with vectorial TC couplings. The choice of NC equal to 2 has the appeal, and I guess, Scott, you asked this question, yeah, that with NF roughly equal to 8, studies suggest, the studies just means you calculate, you know, beta naught and beta 1, and you see where you get that infrared stable fixed point, and then you see where it's close to the critical value for condensation, okay? So these suggest that the Technicolor theory could have an approximate infrared stable fixed point in the confining phase with spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking, but near to the phase transition as a function of NF, beyond which it would go into the putative non-abelian Coulomb phase. Beta function calculations suggest there's some uncertainty in this, that for NF, NTC equal to 2, this infrared stable fixed point exists if, of course, we have that, and the division between this confined chiral symmetry broken phase and the non-abelian Coulomb phase, so-called conformal phase, could occur something like this value. But again, I emphasize that's uncertain. This has two valuable consequences for us. It's going to enhance condensates of fermion masses, and it will also reduce Technicolor contributions to the Peskin-Takeuchi S parameter. This has been studied in quite recent work, by the way, by Alpaquist and Sonino. Many people don't know about this. I suggest you look at that paper. It's a very interesting paper. So just again to review quickly, mass generation for quarks and charged leptons. We recall that this is dynamical, okay? This is a theory that gauges generations, unlike many theories like Higgs, where you just basically put in what you get out. Here, I mean, okay, to be fair, with predictive textures, you can get some predictions, okay? But here, you really try to calculate everything dynamically. So this is how it goes. For a rough estimate, we can consider a one-loop diagram. We come in with a regular Technicolor singlet fermion like this. It emits an ETC gauge boson, shown here, goes to a Techni fermion. This has a dynamical mass insertion as a consequence of the condensate, and then it goes back. It reabsorbs that and goes back. This gives you this mass term. This yields from the coupling. The coupling is obvious. The pi's are obvious. This is a lambda TC cubed from the condensate. This mi squared is from the propagator of the ETC gauge boson. The 8 is an anomalous dimension factor I'll talk about in a second. And the m here is the mass of this, which goes like GETC times lambda I, where lambda I is the ETC scale that enters into the generation of that mass. Okay? The factor eta is a possible enhancement factor incorporating walking. And it is shown here, involving this anomalous dimension. In these walking theories, the anomalous dimension is nearly 1. In fact, that's almost a definition of a critical walking theory. And so this just becomes a log. Exponent of a log is a factor. This is the factor. When you plug this in here, it cancels. It changes that dependence to this. And as you can see, that makes a very important difference because this gives a larger fermion mass because, in turn, lambda Technicolor is small compared to lambda ETC. And in fact, that was crucial for the viability of this whole approach. ETC leads, as we're all aware, to a number of flavor-changing nuclear processes. This is one among several. It does give one of the best bounds. You have an S come along, go to a D, emit an ETC gauge boson. This produces mu minus E plus. Put on spectator U bar. That's this process conjugated. That's this. The current limit from the best of a long series of K2K experiments at Brookhaven, E865, that's a Yale-Brookhaven collaboration, also with other institutions, that yields this very nice upper bound. And in turn, that sets a very nice lower limit on the mass of this ETC gauge boson. So we have then roughly that. The lower bounds on these lambda I's, in turn, because they enter in the denominator of these mass expressions, give you upper bounds on fermion masses. So as you are, I'm sure, well aware, QCD-like variants of Technicolor were ruled out long ago by their inability to satisfy these dual constraints, namely not producing excessive FCNC processes and producing at the same time large enough fermion masses. The walking theories get around that because of that enhancement factor. They ameliorate this problem, and most, essentially all modern technicolor theories are walking theories. Of course, it's still a challenge, one should admit, to get the top quark mass. That's still difficult. There are also precision electroweak constraints. Maybe I'll go through those later if people have questions. The main thing about this is that it is difficult, well, just to mention, I might as well. In other words, these, for example, the Peskin-Takiu GS parameter shown here from this loop of fermions, a naive perturbative evaluation for each extra electroweak doublet gives you this, N2C over 6 pi times that. We have from these, there are three of these, of course, for color, and one of these, so we have four of these guys. We can, it is possible, using non-degeneracy of the techni up and down and also techni N and E to reduce that. That's easy, you just plug it in here and you can get a substantial reduction. This, of course, is constrained by the other Peskin-Takiu G parameter. There's really another, the U parameter, but here's the T that is a constraint on isospin breaking. But the general comment is that since techni fermions are strongly interacting at this scale, at MZ, one cannot reliably compute. This perturbation theory is not really reliable, and it's very difficult to compute S and T in these theories. In passing, I should also remark, as you're all aware, that this whole analysis in terms of oblique parameters for global precision electroweak fits has been put into some confusion recently by the NUTEV anomaly. The oblique fits to NUTEV with two general data, including NUTEV, do not have good chi-squares per degree of freedom. And that's, of course, as you all know, that's a concern. Okay, so now let me get on to more to neutrinos. You know all this stuff very well, but let me review it in the present context. In general, ETC models will have some set of electroweak singlet neutrinos, S stands for singlet. We'll denote these by chi 1 through chi n sub s. For our theories, this will be 30. It comes from these two fields. These are second rank antisymmetric tensor representations of SU5, so each component, each field has 10 components. Here, this is going to be a doublet under another group, so that'll be 20. So that just gives you the 30. Nothing mysterious about where it comes from. There are three types of bilinear terms that we have. Left-handed Majorana with these weak quantum numbers, Dirac with these, right-handed Majorana with these. The left-handed Majorana mass terms violate L by 2 units, as we all know. They involve what I'll call N. N here is a vector that contains the observed neutrinos and the techni-neutrinos. The Dirac mass terms, of course, also violate electroweak symmetry. They involve the N's and these chi's, these right-handed singlets.
The techni-neutrinos, they are all, the ETC non-singlets, right? But
technicolor
singlets,
sorry? No, they're ETC non-singlets, and in particular, they're the the fourth and fifth components of an ETC fundamental representation. No, they're not. They're TC non-singlets, and in fact, that's why we call them techni-neutrinos. They're members of electroweak doublets with the techni-charged leptons.
Okay. They do have strong interaction between them.
Sure. Strong technicolor interaction, not strong color interaction. Yeah. Okay. So the Dirac mass terms are shown here. Of course, they link these N sub L's to chi sub R's. Okay. The Majorana mass terms involving the standard model singlet fields are shown here, involving these chi's. And I should emphasize that entries in any of these that would violate technicolor, which is exact, are zero. Okay? And so, for example, in the left-handed Majorana mass matrix, the fourth and fifth indices there are identically zero. Okay, so here's in a form you know very well, the joint Dirac-Majorana mass matrix. We diagonalize it. We get the unitary transformation that does that. We combine it with the transformation diagonalizing the charged lepton mass matrix to get the observed lepton mixing matrix. Okay, so let's go on now to the specific ETC models that we'll be considering. Our first model is going to have the gauge group, which I motivated before, the SU5 ETC. We'll have another one, which we call hypercolor, and that is added in the because it will help to produce a desired symmetry breaking pattern. The rest here is, of course, just the standard model group.
Wait, so who is seeing that on the hypercolor and who is?
I'll give you the representations. Oh. In fact, I give them to you right here.
Oh.
Okay? So the representations are indexed. This is a fundamental under SU5, singlet under hypercolor, triplet under color, so these are quarks, and doublet under SU2 left. This is the usual UD quark doublet, and in addition, and with Techniquarks. In other words, I write it out right here. So let me answer your question right here. Okay. So this thing, if I write it out, has five horizontal components. Those are the ETC components. The up part, the down part, same thing. Here are the generations, which are gauged. That's a very profound thing about this whole approach. We gauge generations. That's, of course, very different from standard, you know, MSSM, Guts, Susie Guts, etc. They don't do that. So this theory is a very ambitious theory. It's gauging generations and trying to really confront the flavor problem. Okay, so these are, again, the generation indices. The fourth and fifth are the Technicolor indices. And if we write them in the normal notation, this 1, 2, 3 is UCT, of course, and here D1, D2, D3 is DSB. Okay? And that's the...
And the index A can be 1 or 2?
No, the index A is color, so that's a 1, 2, 3.
So where's the hypercolor?
The hypercolor is not there because these are singlets, okay? Yeah. And so the other one to write it out is the leptons on the left-hand side. So this is, again, a fundamental rep of SU5, singlet under SU2, singlet under singlet under color, right? And I noticed my mic is not done. So it's a singlet under regular color, and it's a doublet under SU2 weak. Okay. So writing this out, N1 through N5, which of course are nu e, nu mu, nu tau, and the techni neutrinos, L1 through L5, which are e, mu, tau, and the techni electrons, and similarly on the right-hand side. So maybe I should pause for a moment because I know this is a lot of content. So is it clear so far?
Where are the singlets that you had before? When you talked about neutrino masses, you had all of these other singlets, right?
These singlets are here.
But are they just complete singlets of everybody? No, they have hypercolor problems. Oh, okay.
These are the singlets, okay? So there's a 10 bar.
Oh, but they also hypercolor.
There's one hypercolor non-singlet, okay? So this is going to be, so this is an asymmetric second rank covariant tensor, and so it transforms like that, okay? Then we have a 10, which is also a hypercolor doublet. We call that zeta ij alpha, okay?
And one of those are just out of right-hand neutrinos?
Exactly. These are right-handed states with the quantum numbers of neutrinos. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep, they sure are. Yeah, you can easily check that. Let's see. So here's 6. They combine with these 6. That's easy. Here's 2. So I need the equivalent of 2 here. Okay, how do I get it? Well, you know, the anomaly of the 10 is the same as the anomaly of the 5. Okay, so I have in units of the anomaly of the fundamental representation. Okay, this is 1. I need one here because this is canceling that. So I need another one. And I get that by having -1 + 2.
Right.
Okay?
Right. So unlike a theory like SO10 where that non cancellation pops out, this has to be.
Exactly. This,
now, is it fair to say that if I play this game, I have to be willing to give up all the nice stuff about SU5?
Okay, I'll get to that later when we get to Pati Salam. You can have quark lepton unification. Right. You can have charge quantization, okay?
Yeah.
What is very difficult to get is gauge coupling unification. That's correct. Yeah, but I'll discuss that later. Okay, so now, having specified the particle content, we just note, in fact, the answer to a question. Each of these non-abelian groups is asymptotically free. You can check that. And it has neither gauge nor global anomalies. The global anomaly, of course, is the pi 4 anomaly, the Witten anomaly, and it's easy to check that the hypercolor SU2 has an even number. Well, it's obvious, it's a 10, of course, so there are 10 of those doublets. Okay. The SU2 hypercolor and SU2 technicolor subsectors of SU5 are vectorial. And this model, if you, as we mentioned in the paper, has a few features in common with the previous one that Tom did with John Turning, but it has a different group and also a different fermion content. It will be convenient as when we label these gauge bosons to use the following notation. It's kind of self-evident. So let's write a graph. This is a complete graph on five indices, K5, with three generations here and two up here for the technicolor indices. The gauge boson that takes us from, say, 1 to 4 will be indexed V upper 4, lower 1 in an obvious notation. Its adjoint goes the opposite way. So, for example, when we break SU5 to SU4, the 9 ETC gauge bosons in the coset will get masses of this order. It's obvious there are 9. You count 1, 2, 3, 4 times 2 for each direction, and then there will be one in the Cartan subalgebra, a diagonal one, which is T24. Similar comments apply for subsequent stages of breaking. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in addition to that model, namely the SU5 cross SU2 cross standard model, we shall consider two others, namely where this strong electric weak model is the so-called left-right model, where we have SU2 right and U1B minus L, it gauges B minus L. And we'll also consider the embedding of that in the Patti Salam model, the so-called 422 model, where the U1 and the SU3 are themselves embedded in the Patti Salam SU4. So let's begin with this, the case of the standard model itself. Okay, so here is the discussion of dynamical symmetry breaking. We're going to consider this and in particular try to identify plausible channels for bilinear fermion condensates. To do this, we use what's called a GMAC, or generalized most attractive channel formalism, that takes account of the attractiveness of the a given channel. So as you well know just from QCD, I've given you an illustration here, we think of this in terms of a 3 and a 3 bar binding to form that condensate, and a measure of that condensate is given by this delta C2. Let me just skip before I get to that to say this. The GMAC takes into account not just the attractiveness of the channels, but also the cost incurred in producing vector boson masses when the gauge symmetries are broken. Why is that important? Well, one reason it's important is that this goes by another name, by the way. It's essentially vacuum alignment. You probably know that. In the case of Technicolor, this played a very important role because it explained why Technicolor forms these condensates, okay, that conserve color and charge. Without the G part of GMAC, it could also perfectly well produce these condensates that violate color and charge and would give masses to the gluons and the photon. As far as Technicolor is concerned, it couldn't care less between these and these. They're all of the form fundamental times anti-fundamental. And so it's the GMAC part that really saves color and charge. Okay. An approximate measure, then, of the attractiveness of a condensation channel of the form R1 cross R2 goes to a given condensate is shown here. The delta C2 is C2 of R1 plus C2 of R2 minus C2 of the condensate. The R just indicates the fermion rep under the group, and C2 is the standard quadratic chasmere defined here. You're very familiar with this for simple representations, and one can work them out for more complicated ones. For example, this is the antisymmetric tensor representation. This is the C2 value for that.
So, do I understand you correctly that you use GMAC as kind of a tiebreaker? It's only when MAC cannot decide on which channel
In general, we don't even have ties, but sometimes it's a tiebreaker. That's correct, yes.
So it only uses a tiebreaker, because otherwise you'd be comparing apples and oranges, right? Because MAC is the dimensionless number you're comparing chasmere and variance, and the other one has some energy cost.
That's true, but as you recall in the Preskin-Peskin paper, the original Preskin-Peskin papers on vacuum alignment, essentially what they do is a kind of Cornwall-Jakeve-Tambulis effective potential analysis. And so what comes out of that literally is a trace of M squared. So they get a trace of an M squared matrix as contributing to that, you know, essentially
like
energy functional.
By something, right? The trace M squared.
In effect, yeah, sure, sure. But you can combine both of them. That's really what vacuum alignment did back in 1983 with Technicolor itself. Okay, so then having specified that as our calculational methodology, we envision that as the energy E decreases from high values, remember this is asymptotically free, so at high values these are small, these couplings get large, and at an energy of around 10 to the third TeV, this is large enough to produce this condensation, okay, bilinear Fermion condensation, 10 bar, 10 bar to go to 5. This has delta C2 of a pretty large number here. It, of course, because this is a non-singlet under SU5, it breaks SU5 to SU4. With no
PV is put in by hand, or it comes out of something?
It is constrained. It is chosen because of the constraint that generically there can be flavor change in neutral currents. And we want to keep these scales well above that. It doesn't really have to be. There's nothing canonical about 10 to the third. I could bring that down. Probably I could bring it down to 300 GeV if I really wanted to. We're just keeping conservative here. Sorry?
Without flavor changing?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe 400, but you know, in that range. It doesn't have to be literally that high. okay. So with loss of generality, we can take this breaking direction as I equals 1, and then this entails the separation of the first generation from the rest of the ETC fermions with I running from 2 to 5. So this is the formation of generations dynamically. This is not our work. This goes way back. But this, I think, is one of the beautiful features of this theory. Dynamically explains generations. Okay, with respect to unbroken SU4, we have this decomposition of the 10 bar. It's a 4 bar plus a 6 bar. It'll be convenient to label these, give them special labels. So the 4 bar we'll call alpha 1R, and the 6 bar we'll call that CIJ. These are where IJ now run from 2 to 5, and this has one index being 1. The associated SU5 breaking SU4 invariant condensate is shown here. And of course, when you do these things, these become pretty simple to analyze. This uses this epsilon contraction here. Okay, and the 6 fields, these CIJs gain dynamical masses from that condensate in exactly the same way as the quarks gain dynamical masses of order 300 MeV from the condensate in QCD. It's the same idea. With our lepton number assignments, this and the result in dynamical Majorana mass terms are delta L equal to 2 terms. At lower scales, depending on relative strengths.
Is that because you assign the C some lepton number?
Yes. Why do we do that?
Yeah.
The reason we do that
say
here.
C lepton number is 5.
Sure, sure. That's right. The reason we do that here is to make the Dirac terms involving C a conserved lepton number. And you raise a good point because in later work, we'll change that lepton number assignment. The physics will remain invariant under that, okay? In other words, the left-handed Majorana mass terms of the observed neutrinos will always be delta L equal to 2. But you're absolutely right. It's in this case where you don't gauge L, it is a convention which L you assign to these fields, yeah. Okay, so at lower scales then, depending on relative strengths of gauge couplings, several symmetry breaking schemes can occur. We'll talk about one, GB. The reason is just because it's the nicest one for our scheme. Okay, so in that scheme, as the energy decreases further to a certain scale we call lambda BHC, the SU4-ETC interaction produces another condensation. It's shown here. This is the condensate that's involved there. This has a very strong attractiveness, delta C equals 5. It's actually slightly higher than the one I just mentioned, which was 4.8, 24 over 5. The reason this occurs at a lower scale is because it's actually repulsive with respect to hypercolor. Okay, And this is the condensate. It is an adjoint representation of the SU2 hypercolor. It therefore breaks it to U1 hypercolor. And therefore, we can set up an isomorphism between these alphas and just charges, plus or minus 1. And the 12 zeta ij alpha fields that are contained here gain dynamical masses of this scale. We have another scale, lambda. We call it lambda 2-3, at which the SU4 ETC and U1 hypercolor interactions produce another condensate, shown here, involving these components of the zeta field. And this finally breaks down to SU2 ETC, which of course is SU2 technicolor. And is U1 hypercolor invariant. Notice that that couples only to standard model singlet fields. And finally, then, at the lowest scale, technifermion condensation breaks the electroweak symmetry down to...
Is it supposed to be obvious from this transparency why you need hypercolor? Is at this stage hypercolor comes in?
Yes. Why do you need it? Right. Because there were some other channels which were either competitive or could actually lead slightly. But they break hypercolor.
So they okay. produce a pattern you don't
yeah.
like.
Yeah, let me. That's exactly right. That's right. Let me give you an example. We have a 10-bar 1-1-1. Okay, that could link with this.
Okay.
Okay. 1-2-3-4-5. Yeah. Right. I guess I need another. Okay. And so what would this do? Well, this would go as to a singlet actually under SU5, but it breaks hypercolor. Okay. So it has a large delta C2 with respect to SU5, but it would incur an energy cost, which for sufficiently large hypercolor coupling would be prohibitively large. Okay. So that is the role of hypercolor.
Okay.
And you're right, in a sense, you could say this is, you know, it's Rube Goldberg in the sense that you'd like to do it without hypercolor if you could, but we need it, okay. It works when we put it in. Okay, it would be very nice to do it without that, I completely agree. Occam's razor would say you'd like to avoid it if you could. Okay, now getting on to the, I'm short of time, aren't I? Okay, so I have to be very quick. Getting on to the calculations then, I guess I started a little bit late, but anyway, our full neutrino mass matrix is shown here. It has a certain block diagonal structure. I will quickly go through the generation of the elements of these submatrices. These are the two Dirac submatrices, left-handed majorana, right-handed majorana. Okay, how do we get these? Well, let's look at the Dirac terms first. The Dirac submatrix is shown here. These zeros are exact. They come from technicolor gauge invariants. These terms come from an epsilon ij type contraction of these techni doublets. Remember that in SU2, although not in any other SUN for n greater than or equal to 3, you can do this, and we use this in a crucial way. So we rely crucially on SU2 technicolor. This is a diagram. It looks like one loop. It's actually going to be two loops that generates these terms, and it involves a very important suppression mechanism. The reason for that is that, and I've shown that up here, the reason is that the alpha 1j with j equals 2 and 3 play the role of right-handed neutrinos that are going to get connected via Dirac neutrino mass terms with the left-handed ones. However, these are four bars instead of fours. Therefore, without this mixing, if this gauge boson comes around, it cannot be absorbed. I need the mixing. That's going to suppress this quite substantially. And that'll be very important in our analysis. Okay, so here's an explicit example of how we do this. These are two diagrams producing these so-called B23 terms. With emission reabsorption of ETC gauge bosons combined with mixing. Here is the mixing graph for the ETC gauge bosons. Here are the relevant mass insertions here. So together, this is a two-loop graph. I'll skip the details. We, of course, go through the standard Feynman diagram calculation here, these Feynman integrals. I'll skip the details of that in view of the time and just give you the results. The results. Using, of course, walking technicolor, we first have to compute those non-diagonal vacuum polarization functions for the ETCG edge bosons. We do that. These are the results. This means a V upper 5, lower 3 go to a V upper 2, lower 4, and so forth here. And this is what we find. We plug that in. So that's a one-loop diagram. We plug that into the other, the combined two-loop diagram, and we get these results for the Dirac matrix elements. These are very small. These are of order 1 keV. Okay? So this shows the very heavy suppression of these Dirac neutrino masses by a factor of 10 to the 5 or 6 relative to the naive values that you get for, you know, quarks and charged leptons of the same generation. This can vary a little bit between different symmetry-breaking schemes, but the suppression is robust. It's a generic feature. There's another Dirac submatrix. I'll skip that in view of the time and get on to the relevant Majorana submatrix. Well, in the hypercolor singlet sector, there's a 6x6 submatrix involving very large entries. Those feed down, as we'll see in a second, to the relevant part, which is this RIJ matrix here. It's a 4x4 matrix. These zeros, again, are exact. They follow from technicolor invariants. This has maximal rank. And in particular, the R23 is non-zero. The graphs that give it are shown here. Again, a two-loop graph where you have an alpha-1-3 emitting a V1 upper 4, which has to mix to V upper 1 lower 5 to come down here. This is this condensate, a dynamical non-diagonal dynamical mass for Xi coming from this condensation here. And when we put all this together, combined with a calculation of that non-diagonal vacuum polarization function for the ETC gauge bosons, the relevant gauge bosons, we plug all that in, do the integral, and we get this for R23. Okay, and this is about 100 MeV. We then carry out the diagonalization of the full mass matrix. What we find is, to good approximation, the electroweak non-singlet neutrinos, the usual neutrinos, are linear combinations of three mass eigenstates. There's a normal hierarchy. The new sub-3 mass is shown here. It does have a seesaw form, as you can see. Remember, B's are Dirac matrix elements. So this is D squared over M, the usual notation, and this is what we get. Okay? But notice that although this is a seesaw, it's a very different seesaw from the Suzy Gut seesaw, right? Where this would be the top quark mass squared, and this would be 10 to the 16. So a very, very different kind of seesaw. Okay, with the above-mentioned numerical inputs, what do we get? Well, we get this value, okay, in good agreement with experimental indications in a hierarchical, normal hierarchy mass spectrum. Of course, this implies that. And we also imply, because of the off-diagonal nature of our BIJ and our RIJ, naturally large nu mu nu tau mixing. There are other details of this also. You can look at the nu sub 2. The nu sub 1 is typically very light, okay, relative to the others. And of course, these are Majorana mass eigenstates.
A little bit too fast for me. You had a theoretical prediction that n nu 3 is 0.05, right? And various numbers you have in your theory.
Sure. So, in other words,
experimental value come from?
Where is the experimental value come? I should say that has a
experimental value. Mass square, right?
If the last ones, the bottom ones are close to zero, then you get 0.05.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What you're saying.
Of course. And furthermore, I should
Why of course? How do I know the bottom ones are close to zero?
Oh, by definition, that's what I mean by hierarchical.
Oh, that's the definition of hierarchical.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, people do consider the case where M2 and M3 are nearly degenerate, but their difference is very small.
Right. But they can be anywhere.
Not quite. No, there are constraints on that. Okay. Yeah.
They still be in lots of places, though. Not anywhere, but lots of places.
Yeah.
So this agreement in theory and experiments a little bit.
I've chosen to take the hierarchical assumption from here.
Okay.
And
hierarchical meaning the other guys are always zero.
No, not zero, just small. Just small. In fact, by the way, not so much less. If you take the middle of the LMA, which is, 5 to the minus 5, take the square root of that, it's only about 8 times less or 7 times less than nu sub 3. It's not a huge difference. Okay. This just describes some of the other features of our model. I've gone through how these other neutrino-like states which are, of course, electroweak singlet neutrino states, gain various masses at various scales, lambda 1, lambda BHC, lambda 2, 3, lambda technicolor, etc. And these alphas, you remember, which were playing the role of Majorana masses in that seesaw, have masses in an interesting range. We'll say a word about that just here.
What do you get for solar
mixing? What do I get for solar mixing? Yeah, the details of the mixing in this model we are still working on, okay? So far, we're just fleshing out the main features of the model. That's right.
Can I understand how much you get out for how much you put in? You have these three lambdas.
I have the three lambdas, yeah.
You have the three lambdas.
Yes.
So far, you've gotten one mass and a mixing angle. How many predictions?
I guess the thing that really is you're supposed to take away from this is that the standard inference that most people make from neutrino masses is, you know, forgetting all details, is that they are a strong indication of a very high mass scale, and, you know, there's a very nice mechanism.
Back to Tony's point. Just tell me, I mean, you predict three different masses and three mixing angles, or?
No, one mass. I mean, it's like this, the SO10 seesaw, they're not predictive.
But those inputs are dynamically determined.
They're constrained by various other things.
In other words, I did not put those in by hand. The various breaking scales were dynamical things. In the same way that you don't put chiral symmetry breaking in by hand in QCD. That's predicted by the theory.
Right. And he needs it to do various things. So it's constrained by range. It doesn't want flavor changing current.
I understand.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's an answer to Gary's question.
Yeah. No. So let me answer your question. Actually, that's in the conclusions. But
okay.
the key answer is that each of us in our own minds, okay, has to ask ourselves, forgetting details, what do light neutrino masses imply for new physics beyond the standard model? Most of us, many people would say, Susie Guts, or, you know, some very high Guts scale. This, in a sense, broadens the possibilities, okay? And it broadens them in a big way, because it says that you may not need 10 to the 16 GeV to get a light neutrino mass. You can do it with 1,000 TeV. That's a non-trivial result.
Can you maybe put just the previous transparent, I think is where you
sure.
have the formula?
Yeah, that's right, yeah, okay.
What I was sort of struck by is there's lambda TC, lambda 1, lambda 2, 3,
yes.
lambda BHC.
Right.
So it looks like you've had four different parameters to tune.
Oh, but that's the point. Those were not arbitrary inputs. In other words,
I thought you only got balance on them.
No. I start with a lambda 1, okay? And then I have my couplings evolving according to RG equations and that infrared stable fixed point, okay? And that really comes out of the theory, okay? And then at each point, in the same way, a good analogy is take QCD, okay? So you start with a small coupling at high energies. It evolves up. It will produce a quark condensate. That's not ad hoc. That's a prediction of the theory. Exactly the same thing is true here. Each of the condensates that break the various symmetries are dynamically determined. Okay. Sorry? Just one lambda, sure, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this equation is one, you choose one thing on the right-hand side for one thing on the left-hand side, right? To be fair.
Yeah, but there are other things we get too besides that.
Right,
okay.
Right. But that's
sure.
where the 0.05 comes in. I'm just impressed that it agrees with the experiment.
Believe me, that was non-trivial, okay? These had had different ratios, I would not have gotten close to that.
Okay.
So I think it is non-trivial.
Okay.
Lambda 1 and lambda BHC are in the same order of magnitude?
Roughly, yes.
Those are sort of, I mean, roughly it says lambda technicolor over lambda 2, 3 in the eighth power.
Right, but not exactly. I mean, because BHC is in there. Yeah.
So this is like a double seesaw in some sense. The Dirac mass is determined by a seesaw, and then you have the seesaw and the Dirac mass.
I wouldn't say it that way, Carl. I would say the Dirac mass is determined by a dynamical two-loop, quantum field theory calculation.
It's almost like a seesaw in the sense it's reducing the effect of
by the ratio, produced by some kind of a ratio.
There are ratios that enter into that, but that's, you know, that's, I'm not sure I'd say it's a seesaw. In other words, when you do that Feynman integral, it's a two-loop integral, because different momentum ranges come in, and because there are mass insertions that are k-dependent, and, you know, after you Wick rotate, there is a function of Euclidean momentum, those have non-trivial functional forms. You have to plug all of that into that two-loop integral and do it. So it's not just a simple matrix diagonalization to get that. Okay, anyway, the last thing I had on that transparency is that the Rij entries, which are responsible for these seesaw, are not super heavy and are actually much smaller than the ETC scales lambda. The resultant electroweak singlet neutrinos, sometimes called sterile neutrinos, with masses of this order, again, the masses are of order several hundred MeV. They're of course unstable, and they appear to be consistent with astrophysical and cosmological constraints.
There are a whole set of new particles from these 10 these electroweak singlets.
Right.
That came from those 10.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And so the whole set. How many are there? 18?
Oh, they're a number, like around 20 or so, 30. But you see, those, Lincoln, those will typically decay very fast. Okay.
They're
various gauge interactions.
And on the other hand, they're not easy to produce.
That's right. Because exactly. Because
they're hard to produce.
Precisely. Because they're standard model singlets, there is a kind of shielding mechanism. That's right. I'll get to that later with respect to dark matter. Okay.
How much could it mix with our neutrinos?
I'll get to that too.
Unless they mix very, very little, they're just completely ruled out.
Yeah, I know, but they do mix very little. Okay. What is R23? It's of order hundreds of MeV. Okay. And appear to...
Can I ask, why is nu3 special compared to nu1 and nu2? Prediction for mu3.
Sure. Why is it special? Sure.
Why can you predict mu1 and mu2?
Good. So let me go back to that. Okay. In the Bij, in that Dirac submatrix, okay, the key thing we're getting is a large B23 and B32, okay? Smaller entries here, but these are large. Those then are going to give us, first of all, large mixing, and also the dominant one is going to be nu3, okay?
Why are those the entries?
Well, okay, and again, a very good question. That comes out of the details of how we actually generate those via these two-loop diagrams. And it is very intricate. We would like to have a simple way of explaining. I mean, it's not that hard when you go through it. In other words, these types of one-loop integrals require, in turn, these types of mixings. Some of these mixings are not present. So then you simply don't get these at this order. So that's the answer to that question. I've done that. And finally, just the last, this was a continuation of the last transparency, astrophysical constraints. And of course, they're also, in other words, the R23, those intermediate mass electroweak singlet neutrinos, satisfy astrophysical constraints, we believe. Those come, of course, from BBN and large-scale structure formation. And I should say, they're not safe by many orders of magnitude. It is cause for concern. And there are also constraints from searches for heavy neutrino emission via lepton mixing in KL2 decay that I worked on many years ago. And that's actually very exciting. I'll get to that in the last transparency. And I guess in view of the time, let me completely skip the other work we did on extended gauge groups, namely the one with left-right symmetry. That is interesting, of course, because the charge operator there has a very elegant relation, perhaps rather profound relation, involving also baryon and lepton number, as is well known since the work of Patti Salam. And the second one is the one that actually combines that U1 with color, lepton number is the fourth color, in the Patti Salam SU4 due to these people. Our fermion reps in that case are very simple. And as you all know, this provides quark-lepton unification, partial unification. In these quartet doublet-type structures, it quantizes charge because it combines U1 and SU3 as a maximal subgroup in SU4, and it relates these gauge couplings. So there's partial gauge coupling unification, and as I mentioned, it quantizes electric charge, which of course any fundamental physical theory should do. However, it is constrained. It leads to various decays like KL to mu e and K to pi mu e. There have been dedicated searches for these at Brookhaven. And consistency with experimental upper limits implies that this scale has to be, again, hundreds of TeV. The conventional approach to the breaking of these used Higgs representations, okay, Potty, Salama, Hapatra, et cetera, et cetera. And then they just put in by hand the condition that the VEVs that break the right-handed symmetry or the U1B minus L symmetry down to the standard model are much larger than the VEVs that break the standard model. So you can ask some questions. Can you, is it even possible, to construct theories where that breaking is dynamical? Secondly, can you explain why that first stage of breaking is very high compared to electroweak? Third, if you can do all those, can you explain light neutrino masses? In view of the time, I won't go through the details, but the answer is yes, we can do all of those things. And then finally, one nice thing about the Potty Salam, it has no Majorana, that's a technical simplification, and it has some other nice features too, but I won't go through them. Okay, so some topics we're looking at right now, this is work in progress. We, of course, still worry a lot about the top quark. We need to get good CKM mixing. The Peskin-Taki UGS parameter is a concern. Nabokov-Zohn bosons are a concern. From an experimental point of view, one thing I'm interested in is I'm talking to a person I've written some papers with already, an experimentalist who's the spokesman of E787 at Brookhaven. That experiment, of course, is K plus to pi plus nu bar. But as a tiny fraction of their data sample, they had a trigger that could actually look for K mu 2 and KE 2, especially here. And just with that, they can improve the bound on the mixings of that heavy neutrino with the light neutrino. That in turn affects the lifetime, and that in turn could severely constrain the that particle vis-a-vis the constraints from cosmology and astrophysics.
That's assuming it's less than the K-mu.
Sure, yeah, but typically it is, a few hundred MeV, yeah. So we're...
It depends what Q is.
Yeah, so we're actually doing this now. That 787 and its continuation in 949 has a lot of data, and a tiny fraction of that data is very useful here. Another comment concerns dark matter. We do have a dark matter candidate. It's a standard model singlet technibaryon. And we're thinking, I'm a layman here, but I'm trying to learn about the so-called cusp problem, which if it's true, is very bad for all WIMPs, and including this. The LSP, other WIMPs, this one too. So one thing I want to try to answer is how serious is the cusp problem? Okay, so in conclusion, we have addressed the question, which I think is a very fundamental one, namely, what do we really learn from neutrino masses about physics beyond the standard model? As the alternative to the kind of orthodox standard conclusion about Susie-Gott-Seesaw, we've explored a different approach, very different, based on theories with dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking. We've shown that it is possible to get light neutrino masses in these theories, thereby providing a plausible answer to what was, in fact, a very long-standing question of whether that could be done at all. Our mechanism does use a seesaw, but with strong suppression of Dirac and Majorana mass entries, no super heavy scales. We have dynamical. We can, I think, justifiably say that this is not put in by hand. This is dynamical. We've shown the robustness of this by looking at several different strong electroweak groups. Of course, this model does have a number of phenomenological challenges. These are characteristic of dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking theories. But at least we hope that the work will invigorate the discussion and broaden maybe a bit the discussion of the implications of neutrino masses. Note that, especially for Tony, that this note that it complements other approaches to neutrino masses that do not make explicit reference to a gut scale, such as Higgs-based radiative mass generation models of the type that Tony has pioneered, since in this case it's dynamical rather than using Higgs. So we believe that this motivates further work along these lines, and I'm very happy to discuss it further with any of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Questions?
Scott, one of the constraints I recall on building an ETC model is that above an ETC scale, SU3 color and U1 hypercharge cannot remain, they have to be embedded together into a bigger group. And this goes back to the original Eichen Lane paper on ETC.
Yeah.
And the argument is that unless.
No, I know the argument, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Aren't,
right.
Those were. Anything else you get masses close
that, to yeah. Exactly. Those were the transparencies I skipped for lack of time. That's one of the additional models that we do. And to me, it's actually perhaps the most appealing model, just for the kind of reason that you mentioned. It's the one where we have an SU4 Padi Salam that does just that. In other words, it takes the U1 hypercharge, it combines it, it's part then of the SU2 right cross U1 B minus L. In turn, the U1 B minus L is combined with SU3 color in SU4. So you solve the problem with the Nabokov bosons, you solve this other problem that Ken mentioned, it also quantizes charge. It's to me, it's perhaps the most appealing of all of them. But it's
more breaking. You have to introduce still more breaking.
That's right, Lincoln.
Breaking schemes.
Sure. But if the audience will allow me to describe that, because although it does involve more breaking, the breaking is a very minimal extension of what one has before. Namely, this is the breaking right here. It's actually pretty simple. So here's our model based on 422, okay? Namely, SU4 Padi Salam versus times SU2 left cross SU2 right. Here's the fermion content. It's very simple. The first breaking, okay, Scott, is this one, okay? So again, it's a most attractive channel. It's a GMAC. It breaks, since this is a 4, it breaks the Padi Salam down to SU3, okay? And it breaks the SU2 right down to hypercharge, in fact.
But it does it again through somehow through ETC.
Yeah, right. This is through. Yes, that's correct. This is through ETC. That's right. So that's the same kind of breaking as we use in our other schemes, and so as I say, it breaks this directly to the to that. The associated condensate is that using this right-handed ansibar and this state here, and then further breaking proceeds exactly as before. Furthermore, we did give an analysis to what we could do with sine squared theta using alpha 3 of 0.118 at MZ, alpha electromagnetic inverse 129. This is we don't even need all the accuracy here on the sine squared theta WMS bar. We put this in, we calculate these, and we calculate what we need to make this work. It can work, okay? And the other, yeah, so anyway, this does illustrate that. It addresses just that problem, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually have a simple question. So at what scale does lepton number gets broken in your simple
model? The lepton number gets broken in the first one. Okay, right. So it's a good question. In model one, we do not gauge L. And to make the Dirac bilinears lepton number conserving, which is the standard convention, we assign L equal to 1 to the Xi fields. Okay. Therefore, the Xi condensate automatically breaks L with delta L equal to 2. Mm-hmm. In the models where L is gauged, the assignment of L is not a convention. Okay. And there, in fact, this is another one I skipped. each You're a very good audience, because each one I skip, somebody catches me up on. Okay. So as I say, if I don't gauge it, that's a convention. In the case where I do gauge it, since these fields are singlets under U1b minus L, they of course have baryon number 0, they have lepton number. So it's no longer a convention. Therefore, the Dirac bilinear, okay, violates lepton number. Okay? So this is very different from the standard old textbooks or treatment. Then, when we get to these don't violate baryon number, okay, as you can see. Now, when we, you know, from, a path integral point of view, we do the integration over the C fields in the path integral. We thereby, by standard methods, generate the left-handed, you know, this is the seesaw, of course, the left-handed terms. They are the key thing. They're what we measure, because these involve the observed neutrinos. So how do we get them? They are delta L equal to 2. And they arise in two different ways. In model 1, the Dirac terms conserve lepton number. These, with that convention, okay, with the standard convention, the right-handed ones violated by 2 units. When we gauge lepton number, the right-handed ones are automatically L equal to 0, but the Dirac ones have delta L equal to 2, and we square them. The physical consequence is the same. Okay.
But at what scale does that happen?
Well, the scale, the various scales at which we do this are, you know, the lambda 1 for the xi-xi, the measured scale at which you could say, in, for example, the Pati-Salam type case, the measured scale where this, first of all, violates baryon number, okay, is the highest scale. In fact, in that sense, it's the highest scale in both ones, okay? Namely, that occurs via this type of condensate right here, okay? That occurs at the highest scale, as does the...
Do you have to worry about other things that will show up at that scale as well?
No, that equals 2, bringing by other...
I mean, once you've got the lepton number, you have an effective theory now where lepton number is not conserved, and you have some extra operators that also...
So you worry about double beta decay and...
For example.
Does
that show up at all? Do you have to...
That got to another question. Namely, what was the admixture of the group eigenstates and the mass eigenstates? Mm-hmm. That's also relevant for how long these... intermediate mass sterile neutrinos last, okay? And that turns out to be, it's of order B over R. In other words, Dirac over Majorana, okay? Remember that D is, this is of order 10 to the minus 6 GeV, it's a KeV. This is about 100 GeV, 0.1, okay? So this mixing is about 10 to the minus 5, okay? It's an extremely small mixing. That's important because if you have 100 MeV alpha 2-3, okay, then you know normally that would decay in a microsecond, but now you get 10 to the 10 in extension of the lifetime, so it's roughly 10 to the 4 seconds. 10 to the 4 seconds for 100 MeV unstable neutrino is allowed, but close to the bounds from BBN and large scale structure formation. Okay, so this is definitely testable as the information there gets better.
But you don't generate any other operators that also break lepton
number. I mean, you can of course generate products of these operators, but these are the key ones that come in. Yeah.
You don't have to worry about the proton decay.
No, in fact, Pati-Salam has this beautiful feature that, although it many people, No. Proton, you're thinking about SU2 Tuft instantons or something, yeah? Yeah. The point there is that we have a really new situation here. We have instantons in a strongly interacting theory. That's like QCD. It's chiral in general, okay? That's like the Tuft SU2 analysis. But as far as baryon number is concerned, SU5 ETC is vectorial on baryon number. So instantons conserve baryon number here. They break lepton number, but they conserve baryon number just the way they did in QCD. So, yeah.
Can I? This may sound like a flippant comment, but it isn't.
Okay.
In the end.
Yeah.
Okay? I have the greatest respect for you and Tom, you know, and I just talked to Tom a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
But you asked for it because you mentioned a famous name in your talk, right?
What famous
name? To paraphrase Einstein, the question, the issue for particle physicists is not whether God plays dice, but is God a Rube Goldberg? And so, you know, in particle physics, when you build models, I mean, I've built models in the past.
Sure.
Is what, how Rube Goldberg are
so
you allowed
to? It's a fair question. That's right. No. So my candid, let me try to answer that because it's a very good question. Of course, if I were asked, does this have the elegance of SO10, okay?
Yeah.
Well, I might say no, but then again, remember when you're playing that game in SO10, remember how Gell-Mann Ramon-Slansky played it. They had a 16 cross a 16, and they had the Higgs they could couple to it, okay? So 10 symmetric, 126 symmetric, 120 anti-symmetric. Now so they use the 10 and the 126, and that drove the seesaw. But now start looking more deeply. Your string theorist friends tell you that you can't use a 126.
This is paraphrasing Gary's question earlier.
Okay.
Right. Gary really wants to count the number of input parameters, number of outputs.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't want to count. But I think the intellectual cost is very high to give up SU5 and SO10. You know, for example, there's all this nice work that Barr and Albright did, right?
Sure.
SO10.
Yeah. Okay, so,
That to me is different to introduce in 126. That's group theory. You know, that's required.
Not exactly. If you don't have 126, you're forced to higher dimension operators. That's messy, okay? But let me comment on that in several ways.
Yeah, no, I want to know the answer to this question.
Sure.
It's not flippant. Because
I know it's not flippant.
I'll go home and do more models, too.
Okay, sure. It's a good question.
I want to know what to do with the rest of my life.
That's right. That's right. So let me add. Yeah. It's good that you
answered.
Yeah. It's a good question. Okay, so now let's say, first of all, how obvious do things appear? How obvious is this? To me, one of the things that really, I wrote papers on Susie Guts too, right? Mass textures, all that stuff, right? But I had the feeling as I was doing that I was, I did this U1A, stuff, the various models for mass matrices, yeah. And I had the feeling that I was picking the various charges and things, we all said these are derived from string theory or inspired by string theory, but they're not. Okay, there's a jump. Secondly, if I look at history, in the case of the Landau-Ginzburg superconductivity analysis and the case of BCS. Both of those use an apparent scalar field. In both cases, it's not a fundamental field. It's a bilinear fermion condensate.
Right.
That's telling us something profound, I think, okay? Because that's real physics. That's not just speculation.
I agree with that point, but it could be at the SO2 level. You know, the 126 could be a composite.
But that would require strong interactions at the gut scale. That contradicts the usual gauge coupling unification to an alpha of 1 over 24 or something. No. That's a weak coupling situation, clearly. Okay, let me give you an additional statement. The thing that I like about this is that, yes, it's complicated, but it starts from a relatively simple set of criteria, okay? I mean, strongly coupled electron systems, are incredibly complicated. But they start from Coulomb's law in quantum mechanics. This is starting from something relatively simple. I agree, the details are complicated. But you have to ask yourself, what are the measures of complication?
It's in the eye of the beholder.
Is that what's called G-man?
That's GMOC.
Let's thank Robert again.
Okay.